Hey friends, I'm Jenny Meyer, and you're listening to the Rooted Truth Podcast, where we look at the world through a biblical lens. We talk about real life, biblical truth, and how to walk with Jesus through it all. Be sure to follow me on social at Jenny Meyer and at The Rooted Truth. Also, be sure to subscribe to the members-only, all-exclusive episodes on the Rooted Truth Podcast by going to www.therootedtruth.com. Now let's get started. Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. I'm excited. I say this every time, but I really, really am excited today for this conversation. I have with me Leo De Sequeira. I said that right, Leo?
You sure did.
Awesome. And we are going to dive into this topic. You know, if you follow along with the podcast and on Instagram, really, both my personal account and the Rooted Truth account, you guys know that I have been digging a lot into eschatology and revelation in general over the past probably two, three years, really. And I feel like maybe the last year or so, the Lord has really opened my eyes, because when I go to read the text, I mean, maybe 5 years ago, I read the text of Revelation and I'm reading it with this, like, almost like I'm putting myself into it and my interpretation of what I was taught into it. And so really understanding how, I think it's called exegesis of reading it for what it is, looking at the context, all of that. And so I've been really trying to do that. And so Leo, I came across your stuff online and I'm just really drawn to your understanding of Revelation and getting away from this fear-based end time theology. The biggest thing is dispensationalism, and getting away from that and really looking at it for what it is. So Leo, thank you for joining me, for being willing to chat today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Really excited to be here.
Yeah. So do you want to start off maybe just by introducing yourself, your background a little bit, and then we'll dive into eschatology?
Yeah, sure. Really quickly, my name is Leo De Sequeira. I live in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And I have been on a journey of discovery for, you know, I'd say the better part of 20 years. So I work in finance today. I'm a director for a financial technology firm, which is very unrelated to biblical studies. But, you know, what I do today was really just something that the Lord put me in, because after high school, I went to Bible college, you know, and I thought I was going to either go straight into ministry, or, you know, at the time I wanted to teach, but God just kind of kept closing those doors. Like, I got my time in, I did, you know, my 4 years, and then he just kind of started to move me away, which is actually a really good thing, because I think what it allowed for, you know, I think one of the real dangers of where education is today for biblical studies is, like, a lot of my friends, like, turned away from the Lord, became bitter, became cynical, or just became very arrogant. And it's really prevalent. I'm not saying everywhere, but certainly that was my experience. And for a lot of my friends that went to other seminaries or Bible colleges, they would concur. And so maybe God really just wanted to guard my heart. And so as it pertains to Revelation, it was always an interest. And really just rereading. So I grew up in sort of a left behind household as well. Bible college kind of opened my eyes to, you know, there's a much bigger world of interpretation. And then that kind of continued onward. So I can continue, but if you wanted to interject, I'll pause.
No, that's interesting. I didn't realize that you were in finance. Now my husband's in the finance industry. And I feel like my path, God has me on a totally different one, getting more into ministry. So that's really interesting. I've never gone to Bible school or anything like that. I have done, you know, all my studies is on my own in the Word, reading different books, listening to different speakers and teachers. And so, I mean, I'm glad that you're still putting stuff out there. Your Instagram, I love the information you put out. So maybe let's talk about that. Like, what got you started? Your Instagram handle is Hopeful Eschatology. That's your website as well. What got you into to start that?
Yeah. So, you know, fast forward, you know, my wife and I have always been in ministry and in leadership. She's been on staff as a worship pastor for various churches, you know, and I've, you know, been on preaching rotations and on the board and that sort of thing. So just not vocationally, like full time, certainly involved in our church community and even today. But all of my studies and that sort of thing was always just very private. And I never really felt the release from the Lord to share any of it. And about 6 years ago, I was unexpectedly laid off from a firm that I was working at. And I was at home for 5 months. Mind you, at the time I didn't know it was going to be for 5 months. So in the midst of like job hunting and all that stuff, I just had an encounter with the Lord where I felt him say, like, you know, it's time to start sharing and start writing. And I did. I wrote my first book, you know, almost all of it in those first 5 months. And it was just really just like brain dumps and, you know, beautiful devotional times with him and that sort of thing. And then I was just thinking, like, how can I, what would be a good handle, you know, to kind of phrase all this? And hopeful eschatology was kind of like this oxymoron that I thought, you know what, that really works, because there is this juxtaposition to it. And so that's really how that began.
That's awesome. I love that. I like it, because when you think of eschatology, you do not think of anything in like closely to being hopeful. And, you know, maybe if you're thinking of the Left Behinds, that view, the rapture, whatever, maybe like it's hopeful once we get to heaven, but before then it's not. So I love it. So let's maybe talk about like what you said, that you were raised on the hopeful or on the Left Behind series. I was too. I am an 80s child. You know, I think we're probably around the same age, and that's what I was taught. That's the only thing, you know, I was raised in the church. My parents came to Christ a couple years before I was born. So I thank God for that, that I didn't have, you know, a poor upbringing. But with that being said, you believe what you're taught at a young age without questioning it. And, you know, so what are these common misconceptions of the end times, would you say?
Yeah, I think, you know, outside of what you experience, anything that's, you know, conceptual, you inherit that information, right? Mm-hmm. It's so we grew up in an environment. And so, you know, in evangelical North America, although I'd say all of the Americas, you know, it really is the status quo. And it's been around for, you know, just shy of 200 years.
Yeah.
And I would liken it to, you know, our children and perhaps our children's children, you know, now grow up and will grow up in a society where wokeism is around.
Yeah.
But you and I, we grew up in a time where it didn't exist. Yeah. And we can contrast the two. So, you know, if you were able to live for 300 years, you would be an individual that can tell you, hey, there was a time where there was no such thing as a rapture, and there wasn't this obsession with all these things that are going to be happening and, you know, that sort of thing. It's just that when you're born into it, society, you know, whether it's church culture or secular culture, can very quickly normalize, standards of thought, you know, and that's kind of what we inherited growing up, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we knew, and always looking out for the Antichrist, you know, when's he going to appear? So, and totally. Even like today with the third temple and the red heifers, you know, we found them in Texas, let's ship them over to Israel. And I mean, I even see people and know people that I love dearly that are so stuck on watching that, like, okay, the rapture is going to be here any minute once they get that sacrifice going again. And it's sad, you know, I've struggled just with being able to, I guess, explain what I have learned over the past few years, and the understanding of what happened in the first century. I know we've dialogued about that before on Instagram, of just like, wow, you know, look at the works of Josephus, like how it lines up. And so it's hard, you know, I see these things pulling people apart, friendships, relationships, families, of people being so closed off to it that they're stuck in what they know, you know, cognitive dissonance, like they can't even open up that. Did you run into any of that, like when, you know, God was opening your eyes to it?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a Pentecostal church, right? And my dad was a pastor at the time, and so I was very much into it. And I remember, you know, in my early and mid 20s, just sharing my thoughts, like, I think there's other ways to look at this. And it was just like very met with resistance. And, you know, had some pastors take me out for coffee, like, you can believe whatever you want, but you got to keep it to yourself if you're going to be in our church, that sort of thing. And I was like, wow, that's really, you know, that's intense.
Wow.
And it's interesting that you mentioned Josephus, because, you know, some of the earliest codices, like, you know, compilations of the Bible, had the works of Josephus in it. Even early, like, Syriac manuscripts, which is like a dialect of Aramaic, so again, like super early versions of the Bible, had the works of Josephus, and specifically only the chapter of the destruction of Jerusalem.
Wow.
Right? So, like, can you imagine, like, in your Bible, it's like, let's make sure that we understand context.
Yeah.
It's like they would insert it in there. So I find that really fascinating. For me, really, the journey outside of that, like Bible college, I really loved the historical aspect, you know, the Jewish Roman Wars, history of what was happening in the Holy Land. And it was like super intense, like first century AD was really, really intense. Even if you weren't a believer, there was so much going on. It really, like, even like Tacitus and Suetonius, you know, these early historians, Roman historians, were like, you know, many thought it was the end of the world because of all the upheaval that was happening in the Roman Empire. But with that kind of in my mind, it was actually the textual journey. So first of all, like translation, you know, my own studies of the New Testament, I was like, Jesus didn't actually say what we're saying that he's saying. Like, that's not what the Greek is saying. Or I've also gone into the Aramaic as well. Going through the text itself is where I started to find different conclusions. And then I started to look for, well, who else has come to these conclusions? And what I found is, like, the further back in time I went to, like, the patristic age, especially, and the early fathers, I was like, oh my goodness, they're like saying the exact same thing. And then you really start to see that, you know, at this end of 2000 years, we have like this rabbit hole of doctrines that we've inherited and schisms and more doctrines that were added and then another schism and more doctrines. And so here we are, right?
Yeah.
So for me, it's really the purity of thought and what were the disciples of the disciples saying and writing and thinking.
No, I love that. And I think it's so important to understand that history, of which someone who has not gone to Bible school, you know, I went to college, completely different degree, just more in education and childhood stuff. But I don't believe I was ever taught anything that happened in the first century when it comes to the Jewish Roman War and how specific things were. And I understand why, because we live in a secular world, you know, and obviously the enemy doesn't want that information, because when you come across that, when you see how closely it aligns, everything fits. And like, okay, I don't have to be scared, right? I don't have to be fearful of the future, because first off, perfect love casts out all fear. So if I'm truly living in Jesus and my salvation in him and being co-heirs with Christ, I don't have to be fearful, especially when it all lines up with, like, look, you guys, this already has happened. So much of it has already happened. So
yeah. Well, when I set off to write, I wanted to actually just have one book. It was like, you know, kind of like a overview of the book of Revelation. I never intended on writing three. I'm working on the third one right now, volume three of three. But I saw that so much context was required. Like there's so much to unlearn, and it's like, oh, you're not going to understand this unless we talk about that. And if you're going to talk about that, then you got to go back here first. And so, Revelation: Dawn of the Sage, which is my first book, was really like recreating the first century world as in the context of John's environment, right? And where he had come from, where he was, and what was about to come. And then that then gives interpretation to Matthew 24 and Luke 21, right? And all of those prophecies of really the first Holocaust and genocide of the Jewish race. And I think that's where, of the many things that we've lost over time, having lost, any sort of Semitic empathy and Jewish empathy, because there really was a lot of anti-Semitism in the first, 150 years onward. And so it was almost like suppressing the Jewish narrative and the Jewish story. But man, according to Josephus, 1.1 million slaughtered, 100,000 sold into the slave trade. As a population that was massive, there wasn't 8 billion people on the planet at the time. In fact, less than a billion. And so it was just huge, the economies of scale. And so, God very clearly says, like, he doesn't do anything without first revealing it to his prophets. And so how can you have this entire people group that, like, a lot of these people were still in a covenant. Even if it was an inferior one, it was a legally binding one. And so how is God just going to be silent? Well, he wasn't, right? So enter Jesus with his prophecies. And I would suggest the majority of John's vision also spoke to, the great calamity that befell the Holy Land, and also the spiritual aspects of one covenant being finally closed off, and then a new age being upon us.
Yeah, I love that you brought up the covenants, because I've ha been having this conversation a lot with people lately of this understanding of we have the Mosaic, the old covenant, and essentially I struggle like putting it into words. I really do, but essentially like there's this overlapping of time. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but from 30 AD when Jesus ascended to 70 AD. So he waited the whole generation to give time to come and accept me, right? Come, you know, I'm waiting till the very last minute because I told you it would happen within this generation. But this overlapping of covenants that you have the old covenant and the new covenant because it had started, but then it came into full effect based on is it Hebrews 7? I don't have it right in front of me, but either Hebrews 7 or 8, where it says the old covenant is becoming obsolete, like this covenant is becoming obsolete. So this
Becoming.
overlap. So am I understanding that correctly? And then come 70 AD, since the temple was the really the embodiment of the Mosaic covenant, God wipes it out. Is that, would you say that is the end, the closing of that Mosaic covenant?
100%. Yeah, that'd be my interpretation of it as well. I've called, that 40-year generation like the a cusp of ages, kind of like a Venn diagram where you have overlapping circles, and that small window is the only point of time where there are two covenants in force. In that context, you start reading Hebrews, right? And so Hebrews is written to people that are coming out of and being peer pressured back into a covenant that is still in force. And much of Paul's writings, Galatians, you foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? Like, that doesn't make any sense unless that covenant is still in force. So now, under this lens, you're like, oh my goodness, yeah, there was this limited amount of time where you could actually legally bind yourself to the law of Moses, fulfill all its requirements, including like the tithes, the sacrifices, and everything. And Paul's like, no, don't, because all who bind themselves will be found guilty and liable to judgment, and that judgment is coming. So Paul is like pleading, like, oh, I wish that I could give my life, right? This is like Romans 9, 10, and 11. I wish that I could give my life for my countrymen so that they can wake, but there's a hardening of hearts that's come upon them. So he's lamenting. And I mean, Paul never actually lived to see the day where that destruction took place. Enter John, right? John sees it prophetically. He was in Asia Minor. I don't know that he ever would have made it to the Holy Land, but certainly you'd be hearing reports, right?
Yeah,
like it,
yeah.
The war waged for 3.5 years until the destruction, and then another 3.5 after the taking of Masada. It was a huge deal. But all of that to say, two covenants in force, cusp of ages, a generation that would not pass away. It's really sad too. Like, I think it was C.S. Lewis that said that, you know, Matthew 24, that specific verse, was the most embarrassing verse in the Bible. And I'm like, well, Mr. Lewis, if you are reading through your, you know, dispensational lens,
yeah,
then yes. But if you elevate your perspective and actually have an understanding of how we inherited these doctrines and these mindsets, it's actually the most chilling verse in the Bible in terms of Jesus' razor sharp accuracy.
Yeah.
And really a great exercise is to read Matthew 24 and then immediately Luke 21, because
yeah.
what Luke does is he says, I got to break this down and simplify it. I'm writing to a different audience. They're not going to understand. They don't have the Old Testament context to pick up on allusions. My audience isn't going to get it. I got to make it bare bones.
Yep.
So when you see Jerusalem surrounded by the armies,
yep.
you know it's going down.
Yep. And that's the abomination of desolation in Matthew
totally.
24. And it lines
totally.
Up with Daniel 9 too. You know, for me on my journey, Daniel 9 was the first part where I feel like God kind of pushed me into, because I kept questioning, well, why 7 years? Why 7 years at the end of time? Oh, this comes from Daniel's 70th week. This is where this doctrine comes from. So let's read Daniel 9 in context. Daniel is praying about his people, the Jews, what is to come after they are released from Babylon, you know? And so
yeah.
breaking it down like that, I'm like, okay, this all makes sense. And Daniel
yeah.
12, in my opinion, Daniel 12, the last book or last chapter of Daniel, is Matthew 24. It's the same thing. It's the same
100%,
thing. And
100%.
It's almost as if Daniel, the book of Daniel, then goes into Revelation, like Revelation's like part two Daniel, like Daniel 2, you know, in
yeah.
a way of, okay,
yeah.
Well, I said this is going to happen. Here's what's going to, like, here are the details.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, it's really, I would say selfish to take the prophecies of Daniel, in Matthew 24, John's vision, and make it about you, right? So imagine going to, you know, the underground church of China today, where there's heavy persecution. You're literally putting your life on the line to follow the Lord. And then you come in, hey, I'm a prophet. I have a word from Jesus. Let me tell you about a people group 2,000 years from now in order
yeah.
to comfort you and console you.
Yeah.
Yeah, mission not accomplished.
Very true. Very true. When you put it like that, that makes sense. Wow.
Right?
Oh, goodness. Okay. So what is the overall narrative of Revelation, would you say? That's a deep question.
Yeah. I love that. I've thought a lot about it. I mean, for me, it actually is very Jewish centric. And much like Ezekiel, you know, the parallels between not only the book of Revelation and the book of Ezekiel, studies have been done, you know, the major themes and the visions and how they're presented, like incredible overlap, right? But Ezekiel being called as a prophet during the destruction of the first temple, right? God, what does this mean? And how do we find hope? What are we to learn? And then John, the beloved, has many roles and responsibilities this time around, but inclusive would be the same thing. Prophesy to the Jewish people, help them understand what is happening, right? And how can they find hope? And so, and my commentary on Revelation is actually based on the Aramaic text and not the Greek, because I really wanted to pull as much of the Jewish heritage as I could. You know, so for instance, Jesus, when he appears to John in the Aramaic, it says that he's wearing an ephod, right? Like a priestly garment, and he's walking amongst the menorahs, and it's actually the word menorah is in there. And so it's this really beautiful imagery. And so then you start to pull in all of the old covenant imagery, and it's the fulfillment of prophecies. And so these quick allusions to people that would have been indoctrinated, right, in the Old Testament and in the visions and the pictures, that's all they would need. It's almost like a little soundbite, and then you know what the song is, yeah. Right? You just drop a little image or, you know, a little quotation, and you're like, I know what he's talking about. But it's, again, it's this theme of like the fulfillment of judgment, the fulfillment of the requirements of the law, right? Even like the Song of Moses, if you go back all the way to Deuteronomy, God actually says, here is what's going to happen. And when it does, I'm going to give you a song, and the people are going to remember this song so as to remember why it's all happening. And so that's why even in Revelation, you have the Song of Moses being sung, right? Yeah. All these different things. And Aramaic, really interesting. You know, it says in Revelation 9, I heard the sound or the number of the army, right? Talking mm-hmm. about the Roman hordes. And in Greek, it's like some preposterous number, right? Like 100 yep. billion or something.
Yep.
Aramaic says 60,000.
Wow.
Josephus, when he tallies up the total number that came with Vespasian and Titus, it was 60,000.
Wow.
So the Aramaic the Aramaic vision is that much more accurate. And then, you know, Revelation 11, it's like our Bible says, you know, leave the outer court to be trampled on. Mm-hmm. The Aramaic says the inner court will be trampled on.
Yeah,
and it's like, that. Oh, that's interesting, because that's actually what Titus's men did.
Yeah.
Right. They and took all the spoils that funded the building of the Colosseum in Rome, right, which still stands today. All that was paid for by the spoils of the Jewish temple. So isn't it interesting that John sees that, no, the inside, the inner court, the Holy of Holies is going to be trampled on.
Yep.
But in my, you know, almost conspiracy theory-ish, this is conjecture, but I think that, you know, those slight alterations were probably made to shift to a futuristic view. Because it's very evident in the earliest manuscripts that, you know, the number 60,000 inner court, it's quite fascinating.
Wow. And Aramaic, it's closer to Hebrew, right? It's a pretty close.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah. It is closer to Hebrew, certainly than Greek.
Yeah.
And in fact, Josephus, when, you know, he, I think at the beginning of Antiquities, he's like, Greek is so hard. Even for somebody as smart as me, I struggled and needed help to write this out in Greek. So in other words, first he wrote it in his own language, which was most likely Aramaic, and then he had somebody help him write it out into Greek. And he's like, this language is very hard. And so I'm thinking, you know, the religious leader said of the disciples, like, these guys are unlearned and unschooled. Well, Josephus was not unlearned and unschooled. He was a Pharisee, right? Very well educated. So anyway, Greek is not in any way similar to Hebrew or Aramaic.
And then translate that to English. And we lose so much.
Lose more again. That's right.
Wow. Yeah. There were a few things in Josephus. Some of the things where he said the stones, these white stones that weighed 100 pounds, were launched over into Jerusalem. Like, okay, the 100-pound hail, like,
No kidding.
And I, like, some of that stuff, I'm just like, wow, like, this is, I had to relearn everything, but it has never made sense. Like, it has made sense for me right now of this was about the, well, first the vindication of the martyrs, right? That's including who put Jesus to death, the Jews. They were the ones that did that using the Romans, but this overall picture of these covenants and going into the new covenant, like, what does that really mean for us today? Like, if we really stepped into what that means for us as believers, I feel like so much would be different.
I mean, if you were to, you know, take on the persona of the devil, it would be the most brilliant strategy to disempower the most powerful entities on the planet, which is sons and daughters of God. And you can't do that physically, but you can do that mentally, right? And so, because by putting all that we've inherited to sometime in the future, what do you have today? You have a whole bunch of people that, you know, a lot of them believe that there isn't even a Holy Spirit, that there's no baptism of the Holy Spirit, that we have no responsibility other than to just hunker down and wait for things to get really bad and then to get beamed out of here. So there's this like escapist, cowardice mindset, which, well, how are you going to fulfill the Great Commission, right? How are you going to make disciples of all nations, baptize in the name of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit when you're just hiding out in your bunker waiting for things to get really bad and then for somebody to come and save you? Yeah. Well, seems like a pretty good demonic strategy to me, and really get you to believe that and then perpetuate that week over week.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, so the whole narrative really needs to shift. Going back to Josephus, though, you know, he saw fiery chariots encircling the city of Jerusalem, incredibly wild. He saw a star in the shape of a sword that shone over the great city for, I think, a year. This is a really cool one. Leading up to when Titus was going to break through the walls, the priests that were ministering in the temple, they said that a bright light overwhelmed them. And then all of a sudden, this thundering voice said, "Let us depart from here." And then at once the light left, and, you know, their interpretation is like the glory left, right? Like, yeah. Oh my goodness, this is all documented, right?
Yeah.
So again, you reread Matthew 24 and Luke 21, it all happened, which is why for a lot of the earliest versions of the Bible, they included Josephus' work in the Bible to help inform you.
Wow. Imagine how that would change so much for us today to have that right in there. I mean, I'm so glad that I got that complete works of Josephus, and then using technology, using Google, being able to like, okay, you know, I've heard he said this, but where is it? And it will tell you. And then I look it up in the book and perfect.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's really, really cool. I've also heard the idea of Revelation kind of in a way being like a divorce of Israel, the final divorce to make way for the bride of Christ, or almost more of like the death of Israel, because in the Old Testament, the wife or spouse had to die and then they were legally able to remarry. Have you heard that?
Yeah, I've heard a lot of iterations. And so, you know, and let me preface, I don't subscribe to any specific theological camp, mm-hmm. whether it's like, you know, I am not 100% partial preterist. I'm not 100% all millennialist. They all have gaps.
Yeah.
So I just try to follow the text, try to be very true to a good interpretation of the text, historicity, intertextual interpretation. That's kind of my lane. And whatever camps that happens to overlap with, no problem. So all that being said, yes, I've heard that it's very prevalent, especially in the full preterist groups, which to me almost border on like, again, anti-Semitism, because some of their language I think is very harsh. You can't have, you know, the Jesus who is picking up the woman caught in adultery, stooping down, also being like, I'm divorcing you, and, you know, this sort of thing. And so I think the redemptive language, all have to die. This is very, you know, one of the core mysteries of the New Testament is we all have to die to Adam, right? So there is a requirement of this death, and the law is death as well. And so for the select few who in that period of time happened to be alive when the law was in force, yes, these things apply to them. And there is this necessary, you know, and so again, going back to Galatians, right, like you have to divorce yourself, you have to die so you can die spiritually in Christ, or you have to die really, like for real. Either way, you're bound to this thing. And here's a couple of options to get out of it. This is like Paul pleading with people, which is a big deal, because Christianity is very transient today. Like, you're a Christian if you feel like it, but then, oh, God didn't answer my prayers and I don't have a spouse yet, so I'm going to leave the faith. That's not how it worked with the law. Like, you couldn't get out of it. You were stuck for life. It was legally binding and it followed you wherever you went. So when that's a bit of a problem, right? So it's you need a very real solution. So I think that's sort of the language, is that had to die because it was in fact going to bring death and judgment upon itself to close itself off. And so I think the divorce aspect is only unto remarriage, because dying to self means to be born anew in Christ, right? And that's whole, sort of the triumph of Revelation, is this holy matrimony, where we collectively, the two become one, right? In addition to heaven and earth becoming one, it's like this great union, right? Abiding. John 15, we see like the full manifestation of what it is to become one, this perichoresis, expressed in a future vision. Although we do get to participate that in that right now as well, to some
Yeah,
degree.
that I think that's the kicker that is so hard to understand sometimes, is we do get to participate in that. Like when we accept Christ, and even like in reading Revelation 19 of the marriage supper of the Lamb, did that happen in the first century? Like, this is where my brain's kind of trying to figure this out. Did that happen
Sure.
in the first century, or is that kind of an ongoing thing? And the final is when we're with Jesus, and I believe back on this earth, like everything is
Yeah.
made new. But
Yeah.
yeah.
I read, Revelation up until 19 in a very linear fashion. I think, you have sort of like the pastoral exhortations at the beginning, right up until chapter 3, and then like chapters, 4 to 19, have sort of a theme to them, and then chapters 12, again, sorry, chapters 4 to 11 have a theme, chapters 12 to 19, have a separate theme, but they're both sort of two trajectories talking about the same historical events, just from two different vantage points. But ultimately, it does, culminate in, chapters 19 and even the first bit of chapter 20 up until verse 6. But it really is this, the full cessation and defeat of what had become apostate Jerusalem, which I think is more demonic than physical. It's not, we're not, Paul's like, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, right? But against principalities and rulers. And so we have, this really like this throne of Satan and this legal framework that he was able to maneuver himself into by misappropriating some of the authority that came out of the law. That whole system got shut down, right? And the requirements of the law were completely accomplished and it was done, which is why today, when people talk about the Holy Spirit came so we can fulfill the law, I was like, well, good luck finding a Levite to tithe to, or a temple to sacrifice in, because both don't exist. But that to me takes us then to Revelation chapter 20, and I would look at, verses 6, 7, and 8. That's really where we are today, because there's a few factors. Again, contrasting Ezekiel's present visions, which take up about, more than three quarters of his book, are very descriptive, right? It's either past tense or now, stuff that's immediate, it's happening, like very just. And then he starts looking at the future, and things become less clear, less descriptive, a little more skewed. This is amplified in John, because all of a sudden John goes from like, I can describe, the armor that the Roman guards are wearing, to it's like verse by verse, monumental quick hits. Like, what do you mean a great army? What do you mean surrounding the city? What do you mean fire comes from heaven? What do you mean everybody's been resurrected? And he just drops like these cataclysmic events in like three verses. And like, okay, not a lot of description. Why? Because the attention now goes to the future, right? So the kicker is like, we now have the full expression of the messianic age. The cusp of ages is over, right? The overlapping circles in that Venn diagram. That's done. There's like a full delineation now. And we are fully, you know, I kind of say like the lunar eclipse is over.
Yeah.
Right. And now we have the full radiance of the sun. And that's the age that we're in right now. And then he starts to look at the tail end of that age, right? The one that we're in right now. And he starts to see some things, but it's kind of like if you've ever used binoculars, you know, when you're looking 300 yards, yeah, you can make out an elk or a deer, but it's, you're like, I can't tell you specifically, you know, what's going on, right? Especially with a person. I don't know if they're missing a finger or not. It's a little fuzzy. I know that there's a person there and they're walking in a field. I can't get much closer than that.
Yeah. Okay. That makes it, that makes a lot of sense. So essentially Satan has been bound, in my opinion, whether that happened when Jesus was here, during his ministry, because there are verses that support that, or it was like that final thing when the temple fell, you know, what are your thoughts on that before I go further?
Ooh, yeah. I mean, so can I give a little history?
Go for it.
So this is not Leo's interpretation. I will share what the earliest fathers, right? So patristic interpretation. We would call this Orthodox Christianity. Orthodox just means like we subscribe to the teachings of the fathers, right? And we will pass those down. So it, I know it sounds really scary. It's like, I don't even know what that word means, but let's just call it like the first church before, you know, the schism, you know, of 451. And even after that, you know, in 1053, the Great Schism. But let's say like the first 600 years of the church, it was predominantly united, right? It was, you know, Semitic and Greek. And so they believed that when Jesus descended into Hades, which, wait a minute, how did Jesus ascend into Hades? Well, 1 Peter 3:19, our Bible says, you know, he descended and set free the prisoners in prison, right? If you didn't know that, that's what it says. It's like he descended into prison and set prisoners free. But again, in the Aramaic Bible, it says Sheol. It says that Jesus descended into Sheol. And so many early fathers were like, when he descended in Sheol, so they're not even, they're like, when he descended in Sheol is when he took the keys, which is why in Revelation, you know, 1:18, I have the keys of death and Sheol in the Aramaic Bible. The Greek Bible says Hades, but I don't think that's what he said. So, you know, in those musings, some early fathers also speculated that, you know, he emptied out Sheol. It's known as the harrowing of Sheol. This is a 1900-year-old church tradition of belief. So it's not new. It's old, old that we don't know about it.
Yeah.
He emptied out Sheol. And then some suggested that, you know, you people get out, and then he bound the strong man. So taking Jesus' analogy of binding the strong man, and he actually did it. It's like, okay, now Satan, you come in and I'm going to lock you here where these people were bound.
Yeah.
It's kind of like this great triumph of what he accomplished in the harrowing of Hades or the harrowing of Sheol, and setting the captives free. And then that's where he bound. So long answer to your question. Okay. Revelation, he bound him. Did that happen in 30 AD or at 70 AD? My answer is yes. it's like, because we're really dealing with a timeless realm.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. And so, yeah, you know, and I think great theology has a big chunk of the pie earmarked for mystery.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. Like I was reading a book on, again, Orthodox theology, and they were saying that, you know, the early church fathers looked at mystery as something to be celebrated. Like, oh Lord, your ways are higher than mine. Like, wow, this, I don't understand this. How beautiful. And then it's like, today we look at mystery as something to be solved.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that's such a great distinction. And that's true. So for myself, I'd rather take the path of humility and be like, yeah, there's some tension. I think there's some mystery to this. And a lot of times truth is held in tension when it comes to the things of God. And that's okay. Yeah. You know, the tension keeps us humble. So that's sort of the long answer to your question. When was he bound? Going back to some of the earliest reflections on this, suggested that it was when he descended into Sheol to set free those that were there. Does that really line up with the chronology of Revelation? Yes and no.
Yeah.
Either way, in and around that time.
Happened in the first century. Happened sometime back then. But yeah. With all that being said, he is bound right now from deceiving the nations. And that's how the gospel went out, to bring back all nations, to ratify the Abrahamic, the everlasting covenant, of what God made with himself while Abraham was in a deep sleep. And just understanding that that was with Jesus, the pre-incarnate Jesus. But all that to say, Revelation, is it verse 6, 20 verse 6? Is that when Satan is released for a short time?
Seven.
Seven. Yeah. Okay. So the question lies, like, has he been released? You know, what's going on? So what would you say?
Yeah, I mean, definitely from my perspective, it would be a yes. And this is, again, where I would depart from partial preterist thinking. And perhaps even, like, you know, postmillennialists. But again, just reading in the text. So how did I first arrive at that yes? Well, what I found interesting is, like, God seems to work within epic seasons, these rough 2000 plus year blocks of time. And actually, the Jewish sages are the ones that first called this out. And that's how, when I first came across this theory, is by, I think I was reading some, either it was, yeah, I think it was Midrash. And I quoted in one of my books, but it was talking about, like, how there was the age of null and void, which is, like, from, you know, creation until Abraham, right? And then the age of Torah, which is from Abraham until roughly the coming of Christ. And then the age of Mashiach or Messiah, they said, like, God aborted because they basically let him down. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting how they strung together these 2000 year blocks, 2000 and say 100 years roughly. And then the second finding was, like, you know, astronomy and the observation of, like, the cycle of constellations was a very old practice. And even within Christendom, it was normal. Nobody thought it was, like, crazy. It's only with, like, New Age movement and that sort of thing that we think it's crazy today. But again, looking at the Magi, right, the Magi were following the rotation of constellations to know that, like, hey, when, you know, when Pisces or when the ram descends, right, and we have the fish coming up, that's a cusp of ages, that sort of thing, plus the star, of course, that led them. But that's what they knew to look for. And who knows how many hundreds of years they were waiting and just watching the stars and chronicling the rotation. But again, those rotations happen within roughly that same time frame, 2000 to 2200 years, roughly. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, God seems to operate within these epic seasons. And so if John was looking ahead to the end of this third epic season that we're in, right, this third age that we're in, well, we're, you know, just looking at plus or minus 2000 years, we're closer to the end of it than we are to the beginning of it. And so that's where, okay, if that's the case, it says, you know, some Bible says after the 1,000 years, others say, when the 1,000 years should be finishing. So it's not necessarily suggesting that it's, like, you know, there's this hard delineation. It could be interpreted as, like, toward the end of, that Satan is released. And the only thing that he was restricted from was wholesale delusion, right, and deception, which, to your point earlier, this allowed for the gospel to be preached everywhere. You know, we saw the church, for better or worse, have prominence, you know, and it's great. And then all of a sudden, it isn't great, right? And so I was kind of So I'm reading the text and I'm like, okay, well, I have the Jewish sages talking about these blocks of time. You have like the constellations and this whole school of thought of like that also determines epic seasons. And then just the reading of the text seems to suggest we're coming close to the end of this epic season. Okay, well, what do I have any historical proof for that? And so I just started to go and look at history. And then, the first thing that really struck me was the Armenian and the Syrian genocide under the Ottoman Empire just before World War I. And again, we don't know anything about this because we're ignorant in Western civilization, but like 5 million people were slaughtered like over the course of a very short period of time. It's absolutely tragic. Who were the Armenians and the Syrians? Why did they matter to us? Well, they were the first Christians. So Armenia predates Rome in accepting Christianity as its official religion, first of all. And the Syrians, we're talking about like Antioch. So, Antioch just north of Jerusalem, that was like the second headquarters because after heavy persecution in Jerusalem, the Jerusalem church really started to go down. And then after Jerusalem was destroyed, there was no Jerusalem church. And so the headquarters moved to Antioch first, and then Alexandria, Constantinople as well. But Antioch was a huge place. And they were all descendants of Assyria. They spoke Aramaic. Right. So today we call them Syrian. And it's interesting that these are the first people group to be targeted by the enemy for no apparent reason. And all of a sudden there's just this like pogroms against them. Let's wipe them out. And then shortly after that, the Jewish Holocaust. Wow, that's not by accident. And again, millions, like massive scale, right? We've always had pogroms in the past, but never to this scale. And then all of a sudden you look at the stats and there's wonderful organizations today that are tracking these things, but the rise of persecution against Christians in the last 100 years, we really like need to look at these numbers because they're actually staggering. And year over year, it's getting worse, not better. And it's not ebbs and flows, it's a continual line going in the wrong direction. Lastly, again, we've come into a time where all that is right is wrong, all that is wrong is right. Really, like when you can't explain delusion, it's spiritual,
Very true.
right? It's like, this makes no sense what you're saying. How can you believe this? How can you be, oh, hold on, this isn't actually you, right? So, en masse, it's not like a sect. Right, you got a whole bunch of crazy people that start their own cult and they do their own thing and it's contained. No, this is on a global scale, no matter the country. And I was like, yeah, I think that all these factors combined count for some evidence that there seems to be some powers at work and not to mention the world wars. Let's just add those in there. That's kind of a big deal. Yeah, seems like he's at work deceiving nations again.
When did that Syrian thing happen? When was that? Early 1900s?
Mid to late 1800s under the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, I was actually just having this conversation with someone about the 1800s. 1800s, we have first off dispensationalism at the end of the 1800s, right?
Yes,
We
that was my
have,
final point. Sorry, I forgot
sorry.
that point. Dispensationalism, that's a whole other tangent.
We also have Joseph Smith in the Mormon Church. We have
Right?
Jehovah Witnesses, like
Yes.
all of these things. And yeah, I mean, to me, it would make sense that Satan is released. He is absolutely deceiving the nations. And look at where that has gotten us today. Crazy.
Yeah, now I hear, my partial preterist friends and my victorious eschatology friends saying like, no, like he's still bound and this reign just kind of goes on indefinitely. And this is again where I don't really subscribe to that camp. There is a camp that suggests like, this age that we're in is so glorious that it might go on for another 1,000 years. And I'm like, I don't think God's going to wait around. As much as we think we're great, we don't have it all together. And if it really depends on us to actually turn this earth around, we're going to be waiting for a very long time. Whereas, like, God very much loves to operate within seasons and times. And he's kind of like, I'll let you try it out, but then I'll help. I'll let you try it out, but then I'll help. Right. And I really see that that's kind of where we're at. I also think it's a very, it's at minimum at minimum ignorant, at most arrogant to think that things are great. Like, you got a lot of grace preachers that are like, the kingdom is now, heaven is here, this is the kingdom, and it's just going to keep getting better and better. I'm like, that's great for you in Florida or Texas or California. Go tell that to the guys in Sudan. Go tell that to the suppressed Christians in Iran or Iraq. Go tell that to the underground church in China. Go to Mozambique, where they're like actively right now, government campaigns to slaughter Christians today, right now. Go tell them that this is as good as it gets and it's only going to get better. Yeah, no, sorry.
Love that you started with Florida first, because Florida has it all together, it appears.
Has it all together.
Texas maybe not so much with our border crisis right now, but
Right.
so where would you like where has your understanding of eschatology, what's next? Like, I know that's a really broad question, but
Yeah.
what's to come in this next, or what is the next age? Is it the eternal age?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, there's, and again, this is, you look at early patristic thought in terms of, what's to come. And the early fathers, for so many of them, like Clement of Alexandria, Origen, Athanasius, even Irenaeus, Gregory of Nyssa, like these minds, and even to a lesser extent, Augustine, though I'm not a great fan of him, but his earlier writings are very optimistic. But it's really like God is at work saving. God is at work turning hearts to him. And so the great Christian hope was the great resurrection, because ultimately what remains to be finally defeated is death. So yes, spiritual death has been defeated, and so if I die, I don't go to Sheol, right? I'm in his presence. But even heaven as it stands today is temporary. Heaven as it stands today is a holding place, because if you read, the end of John's vision, what you see is a return to Eden. I would say Eden 2.0, because it's everything is enhanced and better. But it's heaven and earth become one, God walking in our midst on this earth, right? And the earth renewed, right? This is Romans 8. Creation is groaning. So all of that beauty happens. And so, Isaiah talks about, on the one hand, darkness covers the earth and is increasing, but there's also the glory of the Lord. And I think we really want to have that mind when you're reading Revelation 20, verses 7, 8, 9, to not be overwhelmed or be afraid, like, oh my goodness, yes, crazy is happening, but the glory will continue to increase. Crazy is happening. But, First Corinthians 15 is probably one of my favorite passages of the New Testament, because Paul talks about what the end is. And I always joke with people, if you want a condensed version of eschatology, just read First Corinthians 15, because Paul lays it out. He says, first, Christ must be continually reigning until he puts all of his enemies under his feet, and the last many is death. And then comes the end, when he hands over the kingdom back to the Father. So I have this assurance that Christ is continually reigning. So even though I'm reading about these things in Revelation 20, this deception, this darkness, the surrounding of the camp of the saints, whatever that means, does that mean all believers? Does that mean Israel? Again, yes, right? Mystery box. In the midst of all that, he continues to reign and will do so until he subdues all of his enemies under his feet. Okay, well, then I need to take a step back. Where's my faith? Where's my hope? Right? Because whatever I fixate on, I empower. Right? Whatever I fixate on, I actually give faith to that thing, and that's going to have influence over my heart and life. And I feel like we do so much, that's why I don't do conspiracy theories and that sort of thing, because It is a never-ending rabbit hole, and you are never satiated. You just keep going deeper and deeper, and you're empowering that and actually putting faith in that. So long story short, what's to come? When I answer that question, the great resurrection. The great resurrection is to come, and a judgment, which I don't think anybody needs to be terrified of. And then he makes all things new. And then there's the great longing that we've always had to be able to run up to Jesus and give him a big bear hug in the flesh. I mean, that sounds pretty good to me.
Yep.
That's where we're heading.
So good. So good. Like, it brings tears to my eyes. It really does, because you're right. We don't have to fear. We don't have to fear this judgment. If you are in Christ, you don't have to fear that. But yeah, we're not waiting for some, I guess, catastrophic event, right? Like,
no.
Like that we've grew up believing.
Yeah. And the great interjection of this darkness, this return of darkness, this return of deception, is fire falls from heaven. And everybody thinks it's a judgment fire, like a bad one, like another Sodom and Gomorrah incident. But I would counter that with, okay, two things. If you look at Ezekiel 16, God talks about Sodom and Gomorrah. And first he says, you know, you are Israel, you were nothing. I made you amazing. I made you beautiful. I took you as my wife. And then you went off and cheated with a whole bunch of others. You tasted the consequences of that, but I'm going to restore you. And I'm going to restore your sisters, Sodom and Gomorrah, to their former glory or their former state. And if you go back into Genesis, the former state, like that whole region of the Dead Sea, was like the garden of the Lord. So I'm going to restore even Sodom and Gomorrah to Eden. That's very interesting. And then, you know, you get to the New Testament. The disciples are like, Jesus, can we call down fire like Elijah did on these guys? And like, oh, hold on. You don't know what spirit you're operating of right now. So I think like that whole, oh, God's going to come with judgment fire, like as if to satisfy my sense or need of retribution. That ain't happening. All of God's judgments are restorative. They're not retributive. And if we really pause about that, you know, Hebrews, it's a privilege to be corrected. It's a privilege to be disciplined. But the correction is and discipline is always unto really elevating you so that all that you were created to be is realized. So in God's mind, even the judgment that came upon Sodom and Gomorrah was unto restoration because of the promise to restore them to their former glory, which was like an Eden-like state. So what does that mean for Revelation? What does it mean from the fire? Well, I know what it doesn't mean. So again, there's a lot of mystery here, but what I know is that the fire that is coming, for whatever reason, is unto something restorative, more than it is unto God's anger and God's wrath and God's vengeance. Jesus says in Mark 9, everyone will be salted or preserved by fire. Luke, Jesus says, I come to bring fire upon the earth, and how I wish that it were already kindled. A lot of the early patristic writers, in their musings of these verses and several others relating even to the fire of Gehenna or the lake of fire, we're talking about, and again, I'm not saying that this is what people need to believe. It is good to be informed, though, what the disciples of the disciples thought in their reflections. But they went so far as to reflect that a lot of the times, you know, the invitation is to have that fire in this life and to be purified in this life. But even in judgment fire, there's a mystery of, is it possible that God can even purify, you know, in a spiritual sense, even into the realm of death? And there's lots and lots that's been written about this, not really the focus of this discussion, but Revelation ends with a fire that falls and then a lake of fire. And those are really big question marks. And certainly I've spent a lot of time studying those and just trying to understand what that means. And again, the further back you go, the more hopeful it is and the more restorative it is. It really wasn't until, you know, I recently shared a post about this. There, we had sort of a very Semitic base of the church, which gradually became more Greek focused. And a lot of the Greek fathers were more like, because of their Hellenistic influence, Hellenism meaning Greek culture. Greek culture had this whole economy of, you know, the afterlife and the river Styx, right? And Hades and all these things that would happen. So for these people to come into Christianity, it almost seems like some of these sentiments came with them, because it's a lot of the early Greek fathers that are more judgment focused. And then certainly when the Greek splits off from the Latin, and then that becomes the Roman Catholic Church, the Latin was like, everything is bad. Nobody is worthy. Everyone's going to burn unless, you know, so you really get this shifting away from a grace-centric, hopeful view of really God's economy and the purpose of life and the purpose of creation, from being like so much writing about like union, right? Like John 15 and this perichoresis and this mutual indwelling. And it's to know him, like eternal life for the early Semitic writers is knowing him and all the ways that God, the lengths that God goes to make that happen. It's the prodigal son story, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. To the Greek fathers are like, well, yes and no. And then the Latin fathers are like, no, God's not happy. God hates you. You're a worm. You deserve to die. Guess what we inherited today?
Yeah, that,
right? Protestantism broke off from Latin Christianity,
yeah,
which was already very bitter.
Yeah.
And all we said was like, well, we just don't want to go through, you know, a lot of the sacraments and there's a lot of flaws. Listen, what Luther did was fine, happy, but we just kept going with what we felt was right, as opposed to going back to what our inheritance is in our patristic fathers. So yeah. I think the invitation for, you know, for listeners is to really just go back to the early writings, mm-hmm, and just see what these men reflected on. I mean, they lived very beautiful lives.
Yeah.
A lot of them were, you know, monastic. A lot of them were celibate when you didn't have to, like, mm-hmm, celibacy wasn't a rule back then. It was just a choice. They're like, I'm so in love with Jesus, I only want to focus on Jesus and nothing else. No, it's pretty cool, you know?
Yeah.
That guy must have had a lot of time to focus on Jesus.
Yeah, right. Totally. Do you have any, what are like some resources if people want to go back and read some of those early writings?
Yeah, I'm reading, what am I reading right now? I'm reading, this is a good one. It's called The Victory of the Cross, Salvation in Eastern Orthodoxy. And people are like, oh, that's scary. What the heck is Eastern Orthodoxy? Yeah, it's, we just give like really bad names to old things, but Eastern just means it's east of Rome. Okay. So more of like the Greek and even some Eastern Mediterranean, you know, so again, like Antioch, which is north of Israel at the time, Alexandria, which is like Egypt, which is like a really big Jewish hub. And they all spoke Greek, right? Like, what did these guys think?
Okay.
About salvation. So that's been a really good book. Okay. I'd say that's a great starter.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dang. I mean, we covered a lot. I think
cover a lot.
I love this conversation. I really do. And digging in and really seeing like the history and understanding the history, like I said, was really big for me. So I don't want to keep you much longer. Where can people find your book? Maybe and what's the first one? Because I know you have two out there right now. You're working on the third.
Yeah. First one is Revelation, Dawn of This Age. You can find that on Amazon. Second one is Revelation, Dawn of All Hope. And the third one, hopefully this year, Lord willing, Revelation, Dawn of Eternity. Those are all on Amazon. Easiest place to find me is on Instagram, at Hopeful Eschatology. Also my website, hopefuleschatology.com. And that's where I share thoughts and musings and would love to connect. And a lot of people, strike up really great conversations through social media. So it's always a delight.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have your Revelation study map that you put together. That is on your website. You've broken that down and put like images with it of each chapter and what it's like, really what it's relating to, what it's talking about. So they can find that on
Yeah.
your website as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's just a free PDF that they can have. And I've had people send me pictures, like they printed it out and they kind of fold it, at the back of their Bible so that when they do go to Revelation or if they're working through
Awesome.
a study guide, that they have it handy.
Awesome. Well, great. Is there anything you want to leave the listeners with? I know we covered a lot, but anything left in there that you want to leave anyone with?
I'd say one of the things that fascinates me about Revelation is it really ties into the big why. Like, if the lamb was slain before the beginning of the world, right, which is what Revelation tells us, it means that a decision was made before creation ever took place. So when God looked ahead and foresaw the fall and the challenges and the cross and decided that it was still worth it, that has to impact us somehow in our reading of where we're all going and why. And adding to that, the narrative of the prodigal son, which really is the story of two lost sons. You have the religious son and the wayward son, both misidentifying themselves and their father. That's really the theme of humanity. How does that factor into where we are going and what we're heading to? Thirdly, and this is my final thought, I promise, most of the judgment themes and verses in the New Testament have to do with the end of the Mosaic Age. They were immediate and they were temporal. If you remove the burden of reading every judgment verse in the New Testament off of yourself and understanding that there was an immediate audience that needed to hear those words because literally their lives depended on it, does that change the reading of the New Testament? Those would be some of my parting thoughts, just to
So
give
good.
viewers something to, or listeners something to consider.
Okay, one more question. One more thought really quick. What would you say to those in our world today who are going back to the law, who are saying that we've got to do these things. God said to do these things forever, and yes, we're not saved by them, but we have to do them. What would you say?
Yeah, give them Paul's letters. Paul addressed it. Paul addressed, I mean, I don't know how you can get through Galatians just in and of itself, or Hebrews in and of itself, and conclude. So these are people that are just simply easily influenced by others, because anyone who actually educates themselves sufficiently would draw a very different conclusion. And so my heart really laments. Although I celebrate the sincerity and the desire to serve the Lord, it's beautiful. It's been taken advantage of because we really have a misappropriation of the Gospels in the New Testament. And so the letters of Paul, in and of themselves, are very sufficient because Paul goes hard after the law. It's the law of sin and death. Like, there's so many law statements that Paul has, and then again, entire discourses saying, do not put yourself under the law. So to me, that's an easy one. And it's interesting that you talked about the word forever. If you're going to read the Bible, cross-reference what you're reading against Young's literal translation. It's like 120 years old now. It's free. Bible Gateway, BibleWhatever.com, all the Bible sites have it. Right, it's a very good translation, Young's literal translation, and most of the time the word forever isn't forever, it's age enduring, because the word forever doesn't exist in antiquity. It's actually a Platonic concept. And so it's generally the word olam in Hebrew, right? Aeonos in Greek, actually is talking about age
wow.
enduring. That is very different
yes.
than forever.
And when you understand the close of the Mosaic age, wow, so good. I'm glad I asked that. Thank you. All right, Leo. Well, thank you for your time. You guys, if you're listening, I will put all of Leo's information, website, Instagram, in the show notes of this episode. So we hope that you enjoyed, and I will see you next time. Thanks, Leo.
My pleasure.